This is the Game Designers of North Carolina podcast.
Welcome to this episode of the Game Designers of North Carolina podcast, the first podcast to be experienced rather than heard. My name is Mark McGee, and today we're going to be talking about first-time experiences. I've got two designers here who are here for the first time this hour. Josh, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
We also have with us TC Petty.
Bringing a little expertise to the podcast. Yes, I'm here. Thanks.
Thank God. We needed it.
Yeah. Yeah, this podcast has needed some expertise for a long time. So every now and then we have someone on who actually knows what they're talking about. And We'll see if that's today.
Yeah.
Well, let's jump right into the second most interesting part of the podcast, the Tell Me Something Good segment, where we talk about good things that are happening and some news, whatever. All right. Tell me something good. Josh, what you got?
Things are hard pressed in this section right about now. Everyone's alive, so that's great.
Oh, yeah.
That is okay.
I mean, my son is talking a lot more. I mean, he just turned two, but he's like starting to like have opinions. So that's fun. And his older sister does not care about those opinions. So
is anyone in the no phase? Like everything is a no, everything's negative? Or yeah, is that already passed?
No. My wife is
already
deep in
passed.
That. Your wife is in the no phase. Okay.
But we're all surviving. We're having a good, trying to have as much fun as we can. I'm going to rent, I think it's a skidster. I don't know, like a bobcat, and move a bunch of dirt tomorrow. So I don't know what I'm doing, but I'm sure it's going to go poorly.
Why are you stump grinding and doing all this stuff now? Like what is causing you to want to go outside and like just develop land?
I have the land to develop.
Okay.
It's not 100 degrees outside. And I cut down like 32 trees in my house like 3 years ago. And now the stumps are at least rotten enough to do it. So it's that and then doing all the dirt. And I got a shed. Mostly I'm trying to clear out the entire garage so I can then put the kids in there.
So you cut down 30 trees in your garage and you're just now getting around to clearing them out?
I cut down 32 trees. It cost me very little money because they took them for lumber. They took the timber for lumber. Play Forestport by Nat Levan and Josh Mills. But now I'm doing a bunch of other yard work. And we got a swing set. I got to put mulch around it.
Ooh, that's nice.
That sounds good, Josh. Thanks for telling me that good thing. Similarly, and I don't know if this is even that good, but it's similar. So we could call this the Tell Me Something Similar section. I removed a bunch of the drywall in my basement to be able to isolate where the water is coming in from the exterior. And so that's also like physical labor that is going to cost me a lot of money. So look, we're the same, Josh.
I mean, that shouldn't cost you a lot of money unless it's leak.
The part that I've done was the cheap part. It's just, pulling off the drywall in the basement.
Yeah,
anybody with enough determination can do that.
My 4-year-old has done it. So yeah.
Yeah. But the fixing the leak problems, that's the other part.
Yeah, that's the crappy part.
Oh, but something that's actually good. I have started designing a new game. I've said this before, but I don't know if I've said it in as much detail as I'm going to say it now. But this detail is still very minimal because it's so new that I don't really know what it's about. But I think like you go through the game and like experience things and collect things, and it makes you better at things.
Riveting.
that's where it is now. But
I just knew when you started that's about where it was going to be. I had an idea for maybe I have a game.
Well,
but I'm assuming you took it further than. Did you actually make a piece of paper and do something on it?
Yeah. So I've got some cards that I put numbers on, and I played around with them. The numbers are only there to represent symbols, but it's easier to write numbers as symbols. So like
we have lost the entire listening audience at this point.
No, This is the process, Josh. I don't understand what you're talking about. You just this, you, when you need like when you need a spade or a heart, you just put a one or a two there, and then use the numbers as spades or hearts. You know, it's like it's intuitive.
Imagine that you needed like six different suits, and you're like, why do I need to like think about what the six different suits are? It's going to change to four different suits by the time I'm done. Let me just use 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and this is your six different suits. Easy enough. And so I wrote a bunch of numbers on cards and like pushed them around on the table.
I would like to point out that me and Mark both, we made a game together where we use suits and never use numbers until like halfway through the process.
Well,
so it does make sense. This does make sense in some
ways. He's learned. Yeah.
No, but listen to this. One time I made a game that did have suits, a prototype to call it, well, yeah. And I needed like five different suits. And so I just picked different shapes. But someone commented, wait, you needed five different shapes and these are the shapes that you picked. I picked like a diamond, a rhombus, like a weird
stop
inverted.
Right there. You can stop at rhombus. Everybody beats the picture.
And they were like, why didn't you pick like a circle and a square? And I was like, well, now that you mention it, that does make a lot of sense. But like, it didn't come to mind.
How do circles square diamond the first two shapes?
I love that it's like diamond, rhombus, triangle, like everything that could possibly be diamond shaped. I called it diamonds the game. I don't know why everyone was confused.
A square that's sideways.
Sideways square.
Yeah, I've rotated these squares every possible number of degrees to get the different shapes.
They're all 20 degrees. And then they're just...
But yeah, I'm at the phase of this new design where it's barely anything, but I've at least picked up some cards and put them in different piles on the table to see how they move. And it has potential. So that's where I am. That's the good news.
that's super good. I broke out my Wacom tablet just last night, and I haven't used it for like, 4 years. It's like an old one.
That's the one where the little moles pop out and you have to whack them and they go back down.
Yeah, you whack them. No, I'm going to steamroll over that joke. The Wacom tablet.
Mark did that on his own.
The tablet is like really like it has a little tiny area, and finding the pen was like ridiculous. Like it probably took me an hour and a half to find a pen that's shaped like a normal pen and in with other pens somewhere in some box. So I did find it, and I started working on it. And now that I've been working in like Illustrator and InDesign and all these programs for years. So I guess I have to keep this as part of my tools because my God, does it make things faster. So I've been using the Wacom tablet and I've been making some like little pieces of art and stuff. And I changed my Twitter avatar because of that, just because I was testing out some new ways of doing stuff in Illustrator. And it looks like I don't really like drawings in Illustrator. So I'm going to have to figure out a way to make it look better because it just looks like a Flash cartoon, you know?
Yeah. Yep.
So I'll work on it. But hey, I watched some YouTube tutorials as I do, and I learned how to use my programs correctly. It's great. That's my good news. I'm actually becoming better at things that I use.
That's very worthwhile of you. That might even change your life. The trajectory of the future has been altered by your commitment to attaining excellence in everything. And so the world thanks you.
That is why every day, as an expert, I try to attack a problem as if I were a first timer, right? That's some wisdom.
That's true wisdom, more than has ever been spoken on this episode so far. So the transitioning to this main topic, let me tell you where this came from.
Man, I set it up. I was trying to get the. I was like, oh, here's the segue.
We were talking, and I went and found where I started saying some stuff that was in sparked a whole different thing. And it turns out that whenever I lead an idea with the phrase "hot take," then it sparks some debate about if I'm right or an idiot. And this had a little bit of both.
Well, most of the time, yeah. Go ahead.
And so let me tell you basically what I said, and then I'll summarize what Josh said. And TC even said something. So I was doing some thinking about evergreen titles, and I said, oh yeah, games with a high skill ceiling and low randomness are inherently more difficult for those to become evergreen games, because as those games exist for longer periods of time, then the average skill of the people playing them gets so high, and the ability of a new person to interact in a meaningful way with other players because they're so far below them in a skill level, that creates this gap where that weaker players cannot win, so they stop playing. And so then the bad players keep on dropping out because they just keep on getting further and further behind the people who have been playing since the beginning. And so then the average skill of all the players continues to go up as the weaker players continue to leave and repeat it ad nauseum. And then only the super elite players remain, and no new players will come play with them. And so games that have a high element of skill with a very low randomness factor, it is much more difficult for them to be evergreens, because the nature of those sorts of games makes it so people leave and new people can't join as well. And then I posed the only ways to combat this is either having a game where beginners do always have a shot at winning, even if it's like a long shot, but at least can win, either with something like a decent amount of randomness in there, or, you know, pseudo randomness like simultaneous choices or real-time aspects, something that gives some of the similar effects of randomness, or having like a lower skill ceiling so people can kind of get near the top of the skill ceiling faster, or having like an existing community that kind of shepherds people in. And I said, if you have those things, then maybe that can combat this nature of games that just worst players stop playing, making it even harder for new players to start. And that's kind of where I started. And Josh says, oh, that's obvious, you idiot. And I said, well, if it's so obvious.
Did I say idiot? Because if I didn't, I should have. No, but it is obvious, because you presented it as a hot take, like you just discovered this. Like, everything you just said just sounds like you're reciting, like, I don't know, it's obvious facts to me.
It is modern, right? Like, it's a modern way. I'll give it with an E at the end, like a modern way of thinking, like an artistic way, because, you know, like, it is immediately ruined by thinking of the past. Like, let's just say that the last 2,000 years of society doesn't exist, and we don't have evergreens that have no randomness. But like, moving forward now, I'm gonna slightly agree. I'm gonna do a slight agree to what Mark has to say, in the sense that it will become even more and more tough to get a super mega hit as the years progress if you do have no randomness and a high skill ceiling. I'll agree with that.
Yeah, but in real life, what you said when I said this was, I disagree entirely with what Mark has said.
and that is true.
Not only, I'm quoting you, this is a direct quote. Not only are there examples of modern and traditional evergreens with low to zero randomness, evergreen video games conflict with this, and the fact that every single game in complexity exists also conflicts with this.
First of all, you have to define what you mean by evergreen video games, but we will get to that right now, because that is nonsensical, because you could prove your point 100 different ways.
So we went from there. Let me at least tie it back to the title of this one, Designing for First-Time Experience, because we should go back and kind of detail where we came from and where we got to and where we want to go from there. But one of the things we got to is that so much of being an evergreen is related to getting new people to start. Because even the hot take that y'all are saying is not really that much of a hot take was saying, here's the reasons why people stop playing and new people can't join. But forget about the reasons for now. The problem is that people stop playing and new people don't start. And we kind of went back and forth and ultimately came down to getting new people to play and want to come back and continue playing is the main, like the root way to make something an evergreen. Everything else is either a thing that combats that, or...
Yeah, I would say the root way is that to get them to play and then buy. Because that's what makes it an evergreen, right? Is that you're selling copies, at least it, for all intents and purposes. It's like that's why it still is on store shelves. And I don't care about the randomness part of what you said. I just ignored that completely because I don't think it's important. But the skill part of it, I think, is key, because what you have to, and if we're talking about first time experiences, what the games, usually the evergreen games, are doing is it is giving the first time you play it, it's giving a very similar experience to all of the players that come in and play it. And that way it is, you can communicate that experience to other people, like Catan, like the first time you play it, or Ticket to Ride. Like you now have a commonality with other people, and then you get to play it again, but now understanding how things work. One, you want to do better and have that same experience, which you'll never recapture because you're only ever going to do it the first time. But what you want to do is also translate that and give that experience to new people. And that urge of wanting to transfer an experience to someone, like of being like, I want you to also go to the Grand Canyon and see it. I want you to feel what I felt. That's, to me, that's the magic sauce of what an evergreen does in any medium, really.
Yeah, it makes the people ravenous about telling someone else about it. At least, and we're looking at this, if we're talking about this, because I totally disagree with the basic foundation of it, but if we're talking about like how to sell things and get an audience, like that's what you want. And oh, and here, I'll even double back about the money thing, because this is something that Josh said to me a while back that I've always kept in the back of my mind.
This is not good.
Now, I want everyone to know, Josh sometimes will say something with a little bit of a hyperbole behind it. Just a little bit of hyperbole.
Just a titch.
But he said this to me, and it was Steam has a refund policy that you get money back if the game is less, if you've played the game for less than 2 hours. So basically, if you're making a video game, you need to make sure that the first 2 hours of the game is unstoppably good, and then the rest can be absolute crap, because they can ride, the rest rides on the players having to be like, well, I mean, I guess I got to finish it now, right? But once you've got your money, you can get out, right? And that's a paraphrase.
Sure.
probably exactly worded as Josh said it. But I mean, that's probably like more wild yeah, gestures.
A lot of hand motions.
but the honest truth is, like, if you're looking to sell, like you said, like, and everybody should be looking to sell in some fashion, but if you're looking to sell just straight up, if you're going to go on that mobile route and getting people to buy into it quickly, give them the best possible experience with the most possible surprises and delight that they can right up front, and get them to want to explain that experience to other people, that's like the money right there. If you get like someone that plays a game and says, literally, I feel good enough about this game that I'm going to tell someone about it and have them also do it, like you said, that's money right there. Like that is a guaranteed sale.
Yeah, like one of the nice things about games, and I mean, this also comes into context with books or movies, is people that are like the real fans, the base, the core, the foundation of an evergreen title, is they will want to, they'll gift it to people. They'll make them play it with them. They'll do all those things. And just to put that quote into context, I was specifically talking about when you have to decide on priority of where you're going to put your time and effort.
Yeah, and so, you know, I knew Josh was going to backpedal a bit, but, you know, it's fine.
It's true.
You got to make your money, though.
The thing with video games, too, is like, I mean, hell, like 90%, if you put this game on sale on Steam, like most people aren't going to play it anyway. And then the people that do start it are barely going to ever, they're like, the percentage of people that finish it is so small. You still want to make everything, but
no, I totally agree, right? And the mindset is an awesome mindset to be. Yeah, it's good. But the mindset's an awesome mindset to be in. But as a flip side, right? The reason why I was talking about like Mark's thing, I, you know, fundamentally disagree, is because the foundation of an evergreen is a bit of that. Give the best experience up front, but the problem is like 90. What is it? Like, I can't remember what the statistic is, but it's like 95%, something ridiculous, of mobile games that people try, just, you know, on cell phones and stuff. They play once and then they never play again.
Oh, you know, if you're talking free to play, I mean, it's like 99. Yeah, it's
something crazy. But like, But those games really try to use that as their starting point, and they fail because it really, it's not about that as what really fundamentally makes an evergreen exist. That's just one part. And if you focus all your energy on the first, the very, very first thing that people see and try to give them as much as possible, they might like it, but like,
well, of course, I would not classify that strategy as for an evergreen title.
That's, I'm not going to say it's not going to work, right? But yeah, you have to have other things.
It can work, yeah. But I mean, you got to bring it home if you're going to, like, you got to get home. You can't just stop at first or second. Like, you got to bring it all the way home if you want something that's going to resonate with people. But I think when you're talking, yeah, go ahead.
I am willing to acknowledge that all of this may be true. What I propose we do is, because we all are saying that at least part of it is probably weighted in the first time experience.
Absolutely.
There's a ton of stuff. So I think, let me say some stuff that I'm pretty sure everyone here will agree with. There's kind of buckets of things. One is the first time experience. When you play it for the first time, it's good and we like it. One is the ongoing experience that you want to hook people into. And one is all the outside of the game stuff, like marketing, getting it into the proper distribution. What is the price point? Things like that. And so that third one, let's not touch on it at all. The other one, the other aspects of the evergreens, I think what we can do to make it so that we can have a consumable amount of content, we can have that maybe as a sequel to this, and we can spend this time talking about the first time experience, acknowledging that there probably is other worthwhile stuff that we can talk about in a future episode.
Yeah. So when we're talking about the first time experience, and I always equate it to like elegant game design or good game design. I mean, good is whatever, but it's about layering when people are introduced to the world and them starting to understand. And when I say the world, I don't mean the story. I mean like the mechanics, the environment of the game, the rules of play, all that stuff, is that you build it and design it in such a way that you are very deliberate about the information you are communicating to the player and how many choices they have at any given point, and then layering that information into either complex puzzles, complex solutions that they can achieve, and then you know, building up a big kind of crescendo. To me, it's really important that the hurdle or burden isn't too high too early for any game. And that, I mean, the problem is a lot of like either I say Euros, but like a lot of the American kind of games or whatever, I don't know what you want to call them, the ones with like rule books that are like 15 pages long and like have like 15 different things to happen if you happen to be in the same square, like whatever those are, like that that's a big hurdle to get over. What I would rather is the game kind of allow me to discover it while I play it. And if when I go to play it again, that same process is valid, I'm just looking at it through a different lens the second time, the third time, the 100th time. But the feelings I have on that first time are not one of overwhelming, but one of intrigue. So that's how I try to approach kind of the first timer experience.
Just to jump in and say, like, I think I have to agree that it's it's like that feeling of like, I think the killer app would be like, it's accessible with depth, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And everybody like wants that so badly. Like if you could pick up the box, open it up, and you didn't have to do anything, you just dumped it out on the table and you could start playing. But my God, the amount of options you had that just slowly ramped up as the game went on till for that specific like 75 minutes of awesome, amazing gameplay that is super thematic, also amazingly rewarding and has every single possible variety and surprise, and it tells a story. If all of those things you could do by just opening the box, that'd be awesome. But we all know that like that there is some sacrifice you're going to have to make along the way to do that. But where should you focus your attention? I think exactly. It's super, super important. But again, I totally agree. Like the accessibility with depth is like that is the thing.
Yeah,
I remember if every game could do it. Oh,
I remember a couple years ago. I forget the name of the game that I'm thinking of, but there is some games that came out that wanted to specifically tackle the experience of you open the box. Here's a common board game experience. You buy the game, you get it home, you open the box, and then you read the rule book for 45 minutes after or while punching out the pieces. And then an hour after you open up the box, you are now able to play the game, where the playing the game is what the designers and the publishers maybe spent a lot of their time focusing on. The playing of the game has to be really good, but there's this, you know, hour-long barrier about punching the stuff, sorting the stuff, bagging the stuff, reading the rule book that slows down that very first-time experience. And so there's a game that came out that was like, all right, the rule book for your first game is like a page, half a page maybe. And then there's like some cards. The deck came with some cards in it that were sorted in a certain way. It said, don't shuffle this deck. And as you go through it, new rules are revealed as they become applicable in the game. And there's like a time where a handful of games that were trying to tackle that problem of, I say problem in air quotes for those of you on the audio end of this, this problem of before you play, you have to spend a lot of time reading a rule book, and that detracts from the first time experience.
Yeah. And I think they were trying to solve the problem incorrectly. I think what you're supposed to do there is figure out rules that are slimmer and there's less of them and still create the same experience. Because I think that's, I mean, we all know rules is a burden, but just assuming that your first time in their experience, people either taught you the rules or you know the rules. I mean, it's so great to get taught a game because it takes 5 minutes, 10 minutes instead of an hour. But I think, and these are like practical ways that I think about it, is one, trying to make the rules as simple as possible to still allow for complex interaction, but not murky interaction. Like, it's still explicit how things would interact within this rule set, but they surprise you based on what the environment. So because I make video games and stuff, a lot of what I think about is just the reason why I like, say, Nintendo so much is because they give you usually a pretty limited rule set, but they force you to experience the environment with that rule set in crazy different ways throughout the entire game. And they keep adding complexity on top of it, on top of it, on top of it. But the rule set is still swing the sword, walk forward, backwards, left, right, right, change to item B. Like, that's Zelda, but it's super, it's way more complex. I can push blocks. Okay. Oh shit. Now I gotta, cursed. That was bad. Sorry, editor.
Oh no, we're going to get demonetized on YouTube.
We're going to get demonetized. No, but I think about that approach all the time in board games, because what I want to do is give you a limited rule set and then allow you to discover. And when I say discover, I want you to feel, obviously we've talked about this before, feel clever and everything about how these things interact. But really what I'm trying to do is make such a explicit short rule set, like a bullet point list, that you know what you can do and you know what the result will be. And the clearer that is, the easier it is to play, and the more you can concentrate on the fun part of exploring how all those things play with one another. And I think games that have great first-time experiences do a fantastic job of that.
So as you're kind of going through an example of that, I was thinking, you know, video games, where one of your examples was, they have the benefit of the system enforces the rules. You literally cannot break a rule in a video game because the software prohibits itself from doing
give it to you.
But yeah, I understand there's some nuances.
You know, but yeah, sure.
But in tabletop games, the rules exist inside the players' minds and in their agreement to adhere to whatever the rules are. Whatever they want to do, which usually is informed by what's in the rule book, is what they're going to do. But I do think that there is a lot to be said for making the implementation of the rules so spend a lot of effort making them as clear and as clean and crisp as possible through, like, you know, the way the board is laid out. There's so much stuff that can be communicated through just the visual design of the pieces that it may not enforce rules as strongly as software could, but it can say, you know, there's a space here. I feel like since this space is shaped exactly the same as this deck of cards, and it has the words cards on it, that maybe this is where we put cards, as an example. Like, yes, there are ways to make things very clear.
Can I just say, that's one of my biggest pet peeves. Like, when a game, especially if it's a complex Euro game, right? Like, and you're trying to learn a lot of these things. If a game has a piece that's circle-shaped, and it doesn't go on the circle, My brain lose. I lose my mind when that happens.
I've seen you lose it.
Because it's so easy. Like the main thing that people like, especially because I come from a development of games, and there are some times where I have to explain something that I thought I'd never have to explain to anyone.
Yeah,
right.
Like
it's like this card
piece on the circle tracker.
Exactly. Like it's a square peg round hole thing. Like it's very simple. It's like if I assume that this oval piece is going to go on the oval spot, I don't have to think about that anymore. Like if you tell me like the visual language will match the shape of the pieces, I literally do not remember that ever again. And I'm already just doing it naturally. Right. Mm-hmm. So if you had spaces on if you're doing a complex game, like you said, that visual language can be really, really important. And even for prototypes, it's important because I know from behind the scenes that if you don't do that and you don't stay like true to that the entire time, will give it to someone else and they will just not know what the heck you were doing.
Nope. And I think speaking of that, I think there's a level of trust that we don't really talk about a lot. It's that I think a lot of times, if you look at what the games with really great first timer experiences is, they have built that trust with the player. Like, you know that the circle will go in the circle space, right? Like, I feel that way. I know if I'm playing a Nintendo first party game and I'm in a room, they have communicated to me already and given me what I needed to get out of there. If I'm playing some $15, you know, indie Steam game, I might not have the same level of trust.
All right, I have to compartmentalize because one answer to that question, Josh, I just downloaded a game for like 20 cents on Switch, same exact problem, and it had the worst puzzle mechanic ever. It was put a ball in a circle, but not a circle made of a circle, made of like naturalistic things. So you had to go find the circle and hold the ball and put the ball in that spot. But as you're holding the ball, it's activating the thing. So if you don't have the ball and you're in it, you're activating it. If you do have the ball, you're in it, you're activating it. The problem with that is that as a player, I didn't know that was what's going on. And I'm a pretty good like puzzle gamer, but if you're holding the thing that you think activates a thing and you're activating it without the thing and there's no visual response to it, you're just constantly running around doing nothing. And my God, yeah. Anyway, visual language, super important. I wish I could remember what the other thing I was going to say was now. Solken. So I was going to talk about Solken. So there's a gimmicky game. This goes with one of the arguments that I have is that I don't think complexity is necessarily the killer of an evergreen. I think, in fact, complexity and depth is what makes an evergreen. It's something that like you can look behind the scenes and you go, wow, there's so much there, but it's accessible. And I look at Solken, which is, if you've never played Solken, it is a game where there are actual gears on the board, and every turn you're going to spin this thing. Now, the very first thing you do when you play, you put this game out on the table and unfold it and all the gears connect, you go, I'm going to turn that, right? Immediately your brain knows, I'm going to turn that. You don't have to explain that to people that, oh, yeah, well, it's going to turn. Like, no, duh, it's going to turn. Why would they put movable gears on a board if they don't turn? And if they didn't turn, I would, like, return that game and burn it. Or burn it. One of those two things. But, like, when
do both.
On your turn, when you put a piece on a thing, it is, like, so damn obvious. Even though there's so, like, there is, like, all kinds of information all around. I have a piece that is shaped like a circle that fits into a groove on that gear. And underneath that spot, there is a thing there. All I got to say is you get whatever's under the spot or beside the spot. I can't remember. I think it's beside the spot, actually. But like you put it there in that spot and then you know exactly what's about to happen. Because when you turn that wheel, your guy moves one space and you're like, oh, man, that means I get better stuff. Like when I pull my guy off, it's so good at communicating a basic upgrade system that I would not be surprised that it's possibly one of the best first time experience kind of things. Now, I'm not going to say the whole game is a best first time experience, but I will just say that, like, that right there, if you made a 20-minute game that had gears and you put things on them and then moved them, easy. People know exactly what you're doing. And that's like, those are the types of things that even if you have a complex game, as long as you have something that reinforces those basic building blocks of how the depth just branches out in all kinds of ways, people get it. I can teach Sulcan very quickly.
So I think that goes along with something.
Good, come teach me, because I have it.
Oh, nice. Yeah, I will play that. I like it.
So yeah, something that I was, that's very similar, maybe the same thing, but from a slightly different angle, about hiding the complexity in the physical space. So in a tabletop game, the rules exist inside the human's minds, but some of the complexity of the rules can exist outside of their minds. So in that example, the gears, there's not like a lookup table where they say, when you do this, if this was the last thing that happened, then this is the resource. Like that, what they've done effectively kind of is replace a lookup table that has some cognitive load with a very simple, easy to understand thing that exists in the real space. Similarly, games with, and I don't like this, but this does have some good uses. Cards that have like words on them. Sometimes those games with a lot of cards with words, they have simpler rules because like the special stuff that can happen is written on each individual card. So the rules might be draw a card and then you can choose, play all your red cards. And then the red cards, you know, they have words on them. So when you play them, you just read them out loud and do what they say. So what that's done is a lot of the stuff that you might have to remember, you don't have to remember because it's just written out in the physical world on the cards. So it's kind of like hiding or burying some of the complexity in the mechanics, the physical mechanics of the game, not even the rules.
Well, yeah, burying stuff, I mean, especially Euros, right? So like a lot of times Euros, you start off with like wood and stone. You can't even get, say, iron and I don't know what else, pigeons, whatever. I don't know what kind of Euro game you're playing, but like the amount of resources you can get and what resources are available to you is super limited at the beginning, right? And then it slowly rolls out to you over time. And what that's allowing people that have played quite a few times to do is properly plan and start building up their stockpile. What it's doing for first-time experienced people is it's not overloading them. It's allowing them to basically make maybe mistakes, which really there are no mistakes in if you set up your game in a decent way, but it's allowing them to experiment until they find something that they gravitate towards and then go for it, right? So it brings those skills closer together. Now, of course, a lot of Euros, depending on when they end, I think a lot of the evergreen titles just cut off what you could say would be like 75% into what would be a longer Euro, right? They just basically after an hour, they stop where everybody had a kind of a fair go of it. Whereas you could most of the time introduce some new thing or keep something, keep going. And then those are your heavier versions of those Euros. But I think they do a particularly good job of varying stuff and then revealing it to people.
No, I think that's those are two awesome ones. One, you just reinforced building up complexity. So start small, build as the game goes on. That's a really good thing. And then end it before it should end means that players want to play it again because they didn't get to see their engine like do literally everything it could potentially do. And so the next game feels like there's something unfamiliar. The other thing to what Mark was saying was, man, I was thinking about that, but I didn't know how to say it correctly. And then I thought, oh, yeah, abstracting things used to be such a big problem in game. Because if you remember people trying to learn games like Monopoly or chess or just anything like that, people used to say, it's so complex. I don't know how you could learn games that are more complex than that. And the answer is, well, there's a problem with Monopoly and chess. And they require you to remember an abstract rule that isn't related to the game. Like in Monopoly, there's like weird side rules that are slightly thematic, but they don't actually they're not represented on the board. There's nothing on the board that tells you here's an auction space. Put the card up on the auction space, which why for years there's no tile in, well, whatever. It's Monopoly, so people don't even care. But like, and they probably never even use the auction thing. But like, there should be a space on the board that just says auction. like, it should have been there from the very beginning. Like, it doesn't make any sense that there isn't, because no one remembers that rule or uses it because it's not on the board. Same thing with, like, chess. You got to remember how all the pieces work. Mm-hmm. In modern games, we don't do that. We give you player aids a lot of times. So here are the rules right in front of you if you need to check it. We reinforce those rules with, like, symbols. So you're like, oh, man, this happy face symbol must mean something good, right? And it does. It usually doesn't mean something completely opposite of what you expect, right? It's not like, oh, this gas can. Oh, yeah, I'll use that example because I wrote it down. Don't confuse players.
Yeah, and I think one thing Mark said that I don't necessarily agree with is that the rules are all in the player's head and they're enforced in the players by the players. I think, and you just kind of touched on this, is the elements and the way you choose to represent them on the table also can enforce the rules and kind of communicate them and help you enforce them. So, like, one of the things that I've seen a lot of games do, I think Lagrange that did this with the card. So it has cutouts specific to multi-use cards, but it's basically telling you if you're going to use this way, this thing has to go here. And I really enjoy doing that. So I always want to make in my games a place for whatever you touch, a place for it to go outside of your bits and, like, the things you're collecting. Cause I want you to play with those. I want you to move them around. I want you to shuffle. Like, I want them to be messy. Right. Like,
yeah, nothing worse than nothing in front of you during a game.
Yeah. Because you're like, what am I doing? But I think for first time experiences, and then just kind of for me, because honestly, every time I play a game, it feels like a first time experience because it's been so long since I played it last. So, like, it really goes a long way to have physical restrictions related to the gameplay mechanics and what the experience are to help reinforce and for me to obey by the rules.
I think you guys are just saying I'm right in the sense that you can have a complex.
I don't want to say that, though.
No, it's fine. It's fine. It's Josh says TC is right. That's the quote that we get from this podcast.
Yeah, it is.
But the complexity is not as big of an issue as long as you're reinforcing it through gameplay elements, right? The things in front of you.
I think not to be the guy that's like, let's define complexity.
Well, yeah, like, let's define complexity. Oh, no, stop, everybody. Let's define our terms.
No, but I think a lot of times when you say complexity, people immediately think of the sprawling, big, crazy, everywhere game. And to me, that's not necessarily complexity. Complexity is what are the things I can do with the set of elements I have. And that goes back to, like, my Nintendo example, right? Like,
and
a lot of people say they're kid games, but you're like, ugh, no. Ugh.
I put a, that's the thing. We just are using different terms, right? I like to say depth versus complexity, right? Depth versus, but you don't have to say that. It could be depth, it could be complexity, whatever. I don't really care. As long as we're on the same page that, like, yeah, I mean, a good way to do these things is to do that. Now, I think we're kind of. We might be getting stuck in one area. There's other cool things that you could do to do this. I always like in my brain, I wrote down these things. I was like, make it pretty, make it intense, make it quick, make it easy to learn. All of those things,
TC is correct.
If you did all those four things, you've probably made a game that's at least accessible. You may not have an evergreen because who knows about the depth of that, but at least your first experience, if it's quick, intense, pretty, and easy to learn, is going to be a good one. Maybe.
Another huge thing that I can't believe we've blown over since now about first-time experience is the player has to know what they are trying to do. If they do not know what they're trying to do and the things they can actually change to get there, you're going to have that classic thing. I'm sure we've gotten a lot of times with prototypes. It's like midway through the game, they're like, I'm lost. I just don't know what I'm trying to do. Like, they'll just say it like, I don't know why I'm doing this. Like, those are red flags. And yes, you can say in the rule book, like, you are trying to be the guy that gets the most train points or whatever, but that doesn't help people. Like, Ticket to Ride, I'm trying to build routes. I know how much time I have left, I believe, right? Because you have all the trains at the beginning.
ish.
Because the trains run out. But like you know what the objective is. And I mean, of course, they give you the little objective cards, but you know what the game is. I build routes to places. Now, the interesting, complex part of that is the people that you're playing with, which is a whole other kind of side element to games, is making sure you give people scaffolding for their interaction. But I think it's super important for players to know what it is they're actually trying to do. And of course, that means how do they win?
Yeah.
But
here's another thing that we have not mentioned that I think is critically important. So you can have as easy to learn a game as you want, but if the people playing it do not remember it that way, then it defeats itself. So the way that people remember, there's something about like the two main things you will remember about an experience is what was the most exciting or intense thing that happened in that. So like the climax, and then what is the end of it? You know, in an action movie, you might remember how it resolves, and then you might remember that wicked awesome action sequence. In a board game, you might remember, you know, what was the end game like, and then you might remember, you know, what was the coolest combo that I ever did. You're going to remember those things more than anything else. So even if the first two or three or four or five, or I mean, maybe not six, I mean, seven would be crazy. Even if the first few turns dragged a bit, I mean, at seven, it's kind of gone off the rails at this point. But no, if the first few turns dragged a bit, as long as there is that one really, really cool thing that happened and it ended in a way that felt satisfying, those will be remembered more than everything else. So hitting those points is critical to the first time, because that's what people remember about the first time. And like the next day or 3 days later, what people remember about the first time is then what the first time experience is now. So there's a first time experience about like in real time when you're playing it. Then there's a first time experience remembered, you know, 3 days later. And making sure that the second one, the one that you remember, is also banging, that's pretty critical too. So having like everybody's got to do a really cool thing and it's got to have a tight ending are pretty key to that.
A tight ending is actually, I think, way more important than I don't know. I mean, we do discuss a lot how like it's important for people to be close, but I think it's in a first time experience, it's paramount, because what it is gives them hope. It gives them hope that they could have changed. They could relive the game and say, oh, if I just would have done this thing, if I could have just got these 3 points, in reality, maybe there was no way they could ever win. Right. But it gives them the perception of being able to be better and do something amazing. And I think that rubber banding with scores, however you determine scores or a winner, we typically have everybody gets a score in board games versus like one person wins and everybody loses. Now, I know there's plenty of games that do that, but having that Mario Kart grouping it's something about it makes you just want to do it again.
there's so many things. It's scary to talk about that too on this, because it could devolve into a lot. But like making sure that players are close at the end is good. And I just you can do that by catch-up mechanics. You can give people points or resources if they're falling behind. If you have a lot of randomness, you can have them get a little bonus for being behind. But I'd love to get into that stuff, but like, man, that'd be a whole side diversion. But just I think the best advice is if you find that your players, one player is just dominating and then the game ends, that is a negative, and you should figure out other possible ways to not have that happen.
Yeah, that key about giving people hope is good. Josh, in our game, in Top Pop, so often, like basically every time, what I like to do is, all right, everybody, put your cards out there and we see who has the most points. And then we're like, oh, on that last turn, didn't you get this? But you were going for that. So if you had won that card instead of you, then that would have done this. And if you flip-flop, like sometimes it's just one card, sometimes it's two cards, whatever, then you can turn some of the stuff on its head, which does mean it has the appearance of being really, really close. But a lot of the in-game interactions have enough nuance and subtleties that swinging it isn't really as close as it may seem, but it does seem like, oh, all I had to do was win this card instead of you winning this card, and I would have won the game, is what it feels like, even though that makes it seem a lot more simple to actually win a card then
but the sweet spot with that is you didn't know that information when you could have won the card, but and when you know the information later, you're like, well, I could have done that. Yeah. But of course, you didn't know that's what you should have done. So then it's always, you never remember the past very well. One thing, just because I don't want to go down the rabbit hole TC was warning us of. One thing I try to do that I might have talked about before, but it's about just in terms of the kind of games I want to design and making a simple rule set is if a player asks a question, I always want the answer to be yes. So like, hey, can I sell two of these to this person? Yes. Oh, am I allowed to trade this? Like if the rules is set up, the answer should always be yes, right? And what that really means is I'm trying to not make exceptions to whatever the rule is. I have to make the design hold up to the answers being yes to whatever those questions are. But I think that also applies to a first-time experience because what it does is it keeps removing hurdles and caveats and makes the player feel free to try things and experiment. Because I think a lot of that first time you play any game is doing stuff and then figuring out what the game gives you back from that interaction. And then as you build the complexity on top of itself, you start to understand how to turn the knobs and, you know, the levers and whatever. But as soon as a game has like a caveat or a no, just like in improv, it kind of just turns you off immediately. Like it's almost like you're like, oh, well, screw this if they won't let me do this. I'm sure you've played a game with me where it's like, yeah, only three of those count. You can't add them up to like seven. And I'm just like, well, this is BS. And like, I didn't know that. And this is a garbage game. I won. I don't care what the rules say.
Josh, the game's name is Three is Max. It's like, I don't understand. Everything is just by threes.
But you got eight, and three beats eight.
Beat eight. You're right. I want to just jump in there because you did the thing that I wanted to say. I just had a few pet peeves that I'll jump on to the back of that one. Definitely, if you have a ton of exceptions in your rules, like that is just a big no-no. So yeah, if you can, yes should be the answer. Or at least consistent no's. Like if the game is called, yeah, I have three, you shouldn't have four. Yeah. Of anything ever. So I'll do my little list of pet peeves here. So one is something we talked about. It's reliance on being familiar with the deck right at the beginning. Like hit with a surprise that you had no clue was coming. And
that ruins so many Euros.
So manage your player expectations is the idea. If you're going to have a lot of surprises, hit them with surprises early. But at the same time, like there was a game I played that was a longer Euro called Capitals. And there's a symbol on these tiles that's really important. It allows you to go down this one track. If you don't go down that track, you get negative points. Well, what we didn't know was that during the second entire round of the game, so think like multiple turns per round, three rounds in this game, there is no of this one symbol. So if you don't get them in the first round, you lose points in the first round and the second round, and you, on your first time, have no idea that's coming, and you could lose like 18 points. And we had a game where someone ended in negative points because of that. Because how would you know?
Do they not call it first round negative points? Is that not why they call it? Because that would make it clear that it's only can be manipulated in the first round.
Yeah, it wasn't called Capitals subtitle first round. You're screwed if you don't get this first round. The other thing was too many weird symbols. So if you have like a ton of weird symbols, like some game like Race for the Galaxy or something, that can be a real turnoff for people. Symbols are great, but like if they don't make any sense, you have to teach them every single time. Having a ton of them is tough. Another one is, this is a weird one. This was one for like social games, a ton of pressure on a single player. You can really get somebody to hate a game if you just do, I'll get into the Panic Station example. There's this game called Panic Station where it's kind of like The Thing. People can get infected in turn. The way that you infect someone is you hand a card to them and they hand a card to you when you're in the same room. The problem with this is both players then have to look at their card while everyone's watching and everyone's looking for a potential reaction to whether or not they got infected.
Oh, that sounds amazing.
It would be fine if that were the whole game, but it's like, here's all this other game, and then here's this moment that ruins the game. Because you can't have any reaction at all. You gotta just be like, I just lost the game.
that's bad.
But I can't. Yeah. So not that. And even like game like Spyfall could go bad if a player is the spy for the very first game that they've ever played, and they have no information and they have no way to play the game. If they have to be a spy in a game like Spyfall, they're singled out. They feel,
and they get the very first question too.
Yeah. and if you haven't played Spyfall, you have to ask questions about the location you're in without giving away too much information, but also the spy has no information. They're just trying to figure out where they are. So that could be really, really detrimental. And then the last one was people who interrupt rules explanations. Get them out of your game group. They ruin a first time play. So if there's any way you can put that as a rules addendum, like don't interrupt the person teaching the rules as a rule, or else you get eliminated, that would be good.
let me throw in one more that I thought about. I'm going to use a word with multiple syllables. So heuristics, for in case that's a strange word, it's the idea that it's like a rule of thumb. So in a game, when you're playing for the first time, you will not know all of the strategic depth that the game may potentially hold. In fact, whether it does or does not hold that depth is almost entirely irrelevant for the first play. What that means is all your super nuanced strategies are not critical for the first play. They're critical for the more experienced players. And so making your game have a path to conclusion that can be immediately and easily identified by first timers who are not well versed in the strategic depth of your game is important to the first time experience, while then it may be completely irrelevant once somebody has played it three times. And that's okay, because if they don't play it twice, they're definitely not going to play it three times. But yeah, so having that first order heuristic is the way that it's categorized in my mind. But having it so that a beginner can make decisions that are not abysmal the first time they play and still continue to make progress towards their goal without having to internalize the entire depth of you. That is another critical piece for...
Yeah, TC said something that I thought was unfortunately smart. Manage players' expectations. And that should be applied in the rules, in the board, in the graphic design. Every element of the game should manage the player's expectation in terms of what it is and how they'll interact with it. But I think that's a whole topic that you should do a podcast about. It's just managing players' expectations, Mark.
All right, I will write you down for that podcast episode, Josh.
Yeah, but for the first time experience,
writing it down on the piece of paper right now.
So TC said something. He was talking about rule of explanation, people interrupting, which I mean, I'm sure we've all done it too, especially at cons. But I have gone through 30-minute rule explanations, and then I have to ask this question at the very end: what can I do on my turn?
Mm-hmm.
Right, and that shows you, like, that is a huge barrier, especially for a first-time player. Of them not even knowing, like, I have played a game where I'm the first player. We've just gone through everything. I'm not a complete idiot. And I'm like, what can I do on my turn? Like, I understand how everything works. I just don't know what I can do. So
this is how I design games, by the way. I just make up everything around what you actually do on your turn. And then I'm like, yeah, you'll figure it out someday.
I have played a prototype where you told me just to do stuff on my turn that I think I should be able to do, and it was fine. It worked out well. So I think it's very important to that be extremely clear to players from the table, from the rules, like in a way that it's almost impossible. Like, the design forces you to know what you do on your turn. Like, I roll dice and I pick symbols from them to do a thing. Like, okay, well, then when you learn the game, like, you're going to have to know that, because it's the only thing you do. You roll dice. I don't know. It's something that happens so often, and it's usually always with games that would be very hard for me to get other people that aren't of the same mindset as me to play them with me. And there's a huge barrier for first-time players. I mean, it's a barrier for me. The other thing is, I said before, which is just about scoring, I said make sure they know how to win. But if there's in-game scoring, or if there's active scoring,
making sure that's represented somewhere, constantly reminding people that that is a way you're going to get points at some point. And then relative position, I think, for a first-time player is super helpful. So, like, that's the trick a lot of Euros do, is they have a score track that's always close while you're playing. And then in-game scoring happens. And then, oh, crap, TC scored 125 more points than me after we stopped.
Yeah, who is really winning here?
Yeah, who is really
winning? I'm just going to add, I think all those things are good. I think also a fun surprise is stickers. I really like stickers. So if you can put stickers in your game, do it.
Don't.
I have cover a up. Cover up so. Things, ruin it. No one plays a game more than once anyway, so just cover it with stickers. Man, glue. Glue, stickers, glitter, anything.
Duct tape. That's where you can close the box lift once you're done.
Another thing, and what's funny is I think it's funny that you mentioned that everybody plays at one time, is because we're talking about first-time experiences, but because most people will play the game one time, we're really talking about good experience, satisfying experiences, right? Mm-hmm. Even for the
but it's a paradox. It's a paradox, Josh. If you make it too good, people will play it more than once. So you've ruined your first time experience.
You've wasted all your effort on all the first time.
All this effort
experience.
Is wasted.
Well, what I was going to say is one of the things that really I find gratifying for first time experience when I play a game is at the end of the game, it is noticeable what I have done. I have either built a circle of things that would give me some kind of ability. I've either built like a row or a town, or I have physically made decisions that are represented to me that feels like I've done something.
That does play a lot into like the satisfying end state. Like, mm-hmm. And when the game is over, I remember the end because look, I spent the last 45 minutes building this and now I have this. At the end of this game, I have this satisfying feeling emotion because look at this thing that I made. I agree. And I already said it, so you can skip to the next one, Josh.
I just think it's super satisfying, okay?
It is.
You're
and
right.
You could take stuff apart. Like, that's where Forceport started from. Like, I wanted the whole town. I wanted everything built up, and then you just ruin it. You take all the trees out. You just devastate it.
You know, I was thinking about saying something about setup, but the more I think about it, I'm not sure. Because when you set it up for the first time ever... playing it, like, you're going to be looking at the setup page in the rule book. The, like,
sure,
making setup super easy is more like second time experience. I was playing a game earlier this week, and I play a moderate amount of games, and I was thinking to myself, you know, almost every single time I get out a game, I have to open up the rule book to remember at least one detail about setup. How many cards is it that go in your hand? How many of this thing do you get? What are the starting resources? Everybody gets three of these. But that's maybe more of a second time experience thing.
I don't know.
I got the setup right every single time, but other than that, it's always something.
Yeah, but I think you can communicate gameplay and strategy in setup, and a lot of games do this somewhat well. Like, I mean, obviously you want to have like make a mark for the cards if those cards go there, but like stuff like Catan, you set up Catan. And you already are starting to, because you know probability, you're already starting to look at it as opportunity. Like before anybody even takes a turn or does anything. Like while they're putting out the numbers, you're like, oh man, you're telling me I can get wood and blah, blah, blah. If you've already taught it, right? But as soon as the teach is over, the first thing everybody's going to go look for is look at that setup and figure out how to exploit it.
No, when I teach Catan... I usually start with a one semester course on basic probabilities, and after those, you know, 30 credit hours, then we can start playing the game. So we know, you know, probability curves.
I think that's actually really interesting because I don't even really think about it anymore. But like in Maastricht, the game I've been working on for a while, I had a in setup place a piece on the board. And I did it very specifically so that when you were placing the piece on the board, it caused you to do this thing that happens normally in gameplay. So you immediately place a piece on the board and then get a thing. And that's what happens anytime you place a piece on the board. And I remember doing it because I was like, oh, yeah, because you need to know this. And at least during setup, it is as long as someone doesn't set your board up for you, which would be silly at that point. Like, if you're a player, it's kind of fun to set up your board, especially if you make a decision.
Yep.
But, like, now you know. So
that's another good – like, if you're doing playtests and you notice that,
a rule you have doesn't come into play until like the second or third or fourth round, whenever, like however your game's structured, figure out a way to communicate that sooner. And I say rule, not complexity, right? Because like with Euros, like we were saying, like you can have different resources and different conversions. That's different than a rule. And a lot of games will be like, the first round, you do this, and at the second round, this will happen, or this will only happen if someone else has already put a thing here. And like those things are just barriers for first any player, but definitely for the first time player.
It sucks. Sometimes you're going to have like,
I know,
two, but like,
I know,
but you want to get rid of them all. And it sucks when they just,
I mean, out. I get rid of all of mine. And mine are great.
I just do it. Even if it sucks,
this game is called have three cards and you can have five. I don't care.
Start with five.
Start with five. It's called have three cards.
Draw five cards into your hand. You will never have five cards in your hand.
Well, one of the biggest things with Rocky Road that I get the most questions on is there's no hand limit. Right? There's no hand limit. And people are like, but like, what's the hand limit? I'm like, there's not one. And they're like, but then I could just like draw a bunch of cards forever. I'm like, yeah, you could do it if you want to play that one. Like, because there's all these other systems that would prevent them from making the deck run out. And like, they think they can do it, but they can't. But it really bugs people to not have that limit. And the reason why the limit's not there is so like because there's multi-use cards is so like when kids or people with less skill play, they could just draw to gigantic hands, feel like they're super clever by figuring out what's in their hand to play at the exact perfect thing. And it gives them the impression that they're doing awesome. But if you're a Euro player, you know that is not an optimal thing to do. But it's just funny to me that the absence of a restriction has gotten the same kind of questions that I thought would go away, right? So it's almost like convention, if it's a typical board game player for a first time player, could also come into play. Like, is this normally how this works? If not, then you might have to do extra legwork to communicate it.
Another rules podcast thing. Guess you're gonna have to have a series of podcasts on rules and have one where you just put on all the rules for things that you can't do.
Yeah, it looks like this episode has spawned multiple episodes that we'll have to make episodes about. But
multiple series.
Yeah. I mean, the key thing is just don't make your game garbage. And then you're probably at least halfway there to a good first time.
Here, Josh, let me pull back up something that you have said since I think we all pulled multiple quotes from you from the past.
Did I say this in 2020 or like just at some random point?
You said this on August the 16th, 2020.
Oh, no.
Here is how to make an evergreen. Step one. Make your game not suck. Step two, spend millions on advertising. That was it.
That's it, right? That's just two steps.
Yeah.
I think we could probably just completely erase the rest of the podcast. So that's probably right.
I mean, I'm not wrong.
All right. Well, does anyone else have old quotes from Josh that we want to pull up and ask him about?
Sadly, no.
To all those people that played video games on Steam that I've made, sorry.
No. you know people on Steam. Every video gamer that's on Steam has a perfect sense of humor. They will get that you were just joking around. No one is toxic in that community, so we'll be fine.
Yeah, I think anyone without at least a moderate sense of humor has hated literally every single episode that I've ever been on of this podcast. 90% of the stuff I say, I'm not sure if it's true or not. The other part of it might be.
I will say, when it comes to first-time experiences and a lot of this stuff, graphic design is paramount and trumps anything when it comes to art. So get the best graphic design person that you can possibly get and make them play the game and make them understand the rules. Otherwise, it's like having a rules editor that's never played the game. Like, it's worthless.
Yeah. Related to that, Josh and I are starting a graphic design consulting company.
A lot of people bow.
Yeah. That news comes hot in front of the announcement that you are starting your own graphic design and rules editing company. So so we can't trust your suggestion about how critical that is.
You should not hire me for anything that deals with language. Ever.
Josh's rules that didn't service.
I wouldn't hire me.
Well, this has been one fantastic episode. And let's now wrap this thing up. Any last words before we wrap it up and no one hears from us again? We seal ourselves in the vault.
I mean, I really want to just get some quotes of you saying really obvious really? Stuff.
Well,
hey, hot games are better if they're fun. Mark.
Yeah, well, here the reason hot that I come up that, with these hot takes.
You've said this one before. Hot take. People don't always love numbers. Hot take. No one can count for 34 anyway. Said that.
Well, that's yes, those all sound like things that I've said, and I probably still believe them. Yeah, the reason that they come around, these things come around as hot takes, is because when your ability to perceive things at the next level just ascends, then you come back around to these things that seem obvious, but you appreciate them from a different perspective. And that's what it is. I mean, it's as simple as that.
Rhombus is the new circle.
Hot take, square is a diamond.
I mean, so think about just this. So, like, if a human is drawing these circles, you know, have you ever seen a human that can draw a perfect circle? Aren't all circles, when created by humans, really actually not circles? I mean, so why even try drawing circles? All right.
Hot take. Why even try drawing circles?
It's a new segment called Hot Take, and you just record random people giving their hot take.
All right. Well, Josh, if someone wants to get up with you and ask you how many trees you cut down in your garage, how can they get up with you?
On Twitter at Joshua J. Mills or joshuajmills@gmail.com. There's like 10,000 unread messages, so I'll see if I can get to them. I have a lot of storage. I mean, what am I going to do? That's where you can talk to me. I mean, throw stuff at me at Twitter. I like it. Tell me I'm wrong.
All right.
Say well, TC is wrong and I'll like it more.
But, TC, yeah, if anyone wants to follow you to be able to know when the podcast episode entitled The TC is Right episode comes out, how could they get up with you?
Well, I mean, I'm sure that's coming soon, right? Because it's going to be Josh Mills sponsored. You can hit me up on the Twitters and stuff. I'm at Puppy Shogun. And yeah, that's it. Go do that, because that's the best way to get in touch with me.
Well, if anyone is interested in hearing about something they already know, they can find me on Twitter at mmark40. And that does it for this episode. If you want to discuss this episode or talk to us in general, please visit our guild on BoardGameGeek. You go to podcast.gdofnc.com, and that will redirect you to our guild on BoardGameGeek. We welcome your feedback. We also have a group Twitter account that you can follow, at GD of NC, which stands for Game Designers of North Carolina. Thank you for listening and have a good day. See ya.
Not crap, spin money. Bye.